And then we cut to the dig where Nigel is, you know, coming in to Eric and being like, oh, she found out she's going up river to blah, 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 blah. And he was like, how did you find this out? Oh, Dr. Dubois from the Red Cross.
And I'm like, how does he not know he's the bad guy? He has to know. He stabbed a guy. He's trying to thwart a woman's work in STEM. He's obviously the bad guy. She looks like the emoji that's scratching its chin and being like, The way they make her look like a dip and keep talking about how smart she is makes me want to shaky cam the whole movie. Anyways, shall we cut to a bedroom scene?
Yeah. So it's later in that night and Jerry and Susan are talking to each other and she's just like, look, it's not going to take us too much time, you know, out of our trip if we just go over to this tribe, see what they're talking about, that funny feeling that she had about the bone.
Yeah.
This is like the proof that she needs to kind of do something about it.
But it'll put me in New York 2 days after I'm supposed to be there.
It's like, ah, they've been doing the they've been writing articles without you there. They can survive a couple more days, which valid.
He's angry packing, though.
Yeah.
And I'm like, a couple days is not a big deal almost ever. And he's so mad. He like lays down with his baseball cap on. And then he's like, oh, my baseball cap. And he takes it off. And he's like, turn off the light, will you? And she's like, I'm just saying. He's like, I said, turn off the light. So she turns it off. And I'm like, right now, I'm like, jerk husband, I hate you so much right now. And then when she sits up and starts writing, I'm like,
okay, do you know what he does with his hat, though?
He just chucks it.
He throws it like he's having a temper tantrum, like he's a child.
He is a child. I've met 15-year-olds more mature than this man.
Right.
He's got nothing.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Oh, did you have to hang out in a beautiful country with lots of fun people playing baseball, having bubble gum, and you're just mad that your wife finally got a break right at the last minute and you want to go do your job right now? And I'm like,
but you're ovulating tomorrow.
What's your life going to mean if you're not impregnated with my seed? this man is such a walking cringe pot of gross. Oh, George, Jerry.
So these are how my notes go. George doesn't want to help his wife have a career. Susan says, F*** you, George. I'm going to find a bonehead that matters.
When he wakes up to the note on the pillow, I get my notes go, haha, she left, F*** you. I mean, it's not, it does not end as good as that, but if that's where the movie ended, I'd be like, yeah, good. Okay, so now he's all like, what? And he takes off on his motorcycle, and we cut to her getting taken off in a helicopter, and he like rides, he sees the helicopter fly away, and he rides his motorcycle, he's really good at riding his motorcycle, without a helmet.
It's the 80s.
Okay. He rides all the way to the end of the pier or whatever, right to the edge of the water. He's already seen it fly away. I wanted him to ride off of the dock into the water. That's how I felt about it. Instead, he like turns around. He turns around and he goes,
yeah.
I was like, excuse me. And then he rides back and he starts having a conversation with a guy about chartering a plane. And the guy's like, yeah, no problem. Thursday? And he's like, no, now. And he's like, oh, impossible. And he's like, no, but I really need it. And he's like, well, I do know a guy with a plane. And he's like, yeah, that one.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Enter Kenji Obe.
Oh, I wanted. He has all of the earmarks of being my favorite character, except he f***ed it up in like 2 minutes. I wrote down, I was like, oh, I love this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he f***ed it up.
He do. This is Hugh Quarshie, or Quarshie, depending. It's a Q-U, but it might be a hard K. I don't know. Hugh Quarshie played Captain Panaka in Star Wars. He's a Naboo official. And there is a Star Wars link between him and William Catt. William Catt also auditioned for Luke Skywalker in Episode 4.
So glad we got Mark Hamill.
Oh, yeah. Oh, 100 times. Yeah. This guy looks like, I thought for like a split second, because I have dumb Caucasian brain, It's not that I hate all white people. You just have to understand that, like, most of them suck. But he looks like a poor man's Cuba Gooding Jr., right? A little bit?
Oh, are you talking about George or Kenji?
George doesn't look anything like Cuba Gooding Jr.
You were just saying, okay, sorry, you said your Caucasian brain and then you said all white people. And so I automatically was like, we were talking about a white guy.
Yeah, no,
okay,
no.
Never mind. I'm going to edit that out.
No, it's fine. I just said that. I mean, he does. The Keshi.
Hugh Carshi.
Carshi looks like Cuba Gooding Jr. a little bit. And there's like a couple scenes in movies I've seen with Cuba Gooding Jr. where he like excitedly talks while driving and turns and looks and then goes back. And so the mannerism and his face, it just reminded me so much of him for like whole first scene while I loved him until he f***ed it up.
I was looking through IMDb and I was like, I think this guy looks familiar. Where have I seen him before? And then when I go into the IMDb, I'm like, he was the one who presented R2-D2 to Queen Amidala. It was great.
So after my notes say, hey, this bush pilot is awesome, and you can just hold that with a grain of salt, get it ready, then George Beg is like, oh, they start talking over each other, which is very difficult for me to follow.
Right. Okay. So what Kenji is talking about is he's really selling his flights. He's like, oh, he even gives a nice little spiel with it. But then he's like, I'm all out of brochures. And I was like, I want to see one of his brochures because that'd be so great.
It'd be great.
But like as George Jerry is talking about his problems, which my note was therapy with pilot, who's just trying to show you around. Eventually, Kenji, we get to the part that you hate.
Yeah. Okay. But first,
and I hate it too.
Okay, and you should. First, I'm going to combine George and Jerry. His name is Jory now. Jory is like, and you know, this godforsaken country, right?
Oh, yeah.
He says godforsaken country, which makes me hate him. I already hated him. But I'm like, okay. But then he's just like, and yeah, now that I'm stuck in deepest, darkest, oh, because he's going to say deepest, darkest Africa. Right?
Okay, yeah. He's saying like he's complaining over the fact that Susan doesn't want to have kids. And he's like, she's making it seem like it's just this, you know, culture that's from the deepest, darkest.
Yeah, like
and then he stops himself.
Primate brain.
Do you want to know what my note was? It's right there. Dark ages.
Yeah, right? But he said he was going to say Africa.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean he could have fixed it?
He could have fixed it if he had just, like, that was what I thought he was going to be saying, was dark ages. No.
This is the thing. I have said accidental racist shit. If you are Caucasian,
it's going
to
happen.
You've done it. Like, you have. Your teachability and vulnerability to be taught is important. And he doesn't. He's just as racist as a piece of crap as he is at the beginning of this film as the end. His character arc is a straight line, as far as I'm concerned. I hate Jory so much that this bush pilot, actually, even though I'm about to hate him, isn't so bad. Like, Jory is real bad. Bush pilot, okay, he does a dip, but he also doesn't arc either. So, like, what happens, he goes, what would you do? Well, he talks about how he mentions his six siblings or whatever. And he's like, oh, yeah, no, I was 19. And he's like, what? He's like, yeah, my dad had like four wives. Yeah, four wives. And Jory's like, what? And he's all like, well, what would you do if you were in my situation? Right. And Bush Pilot turns to him and goes, oh, yeah, I just beat my wife. And that's a comedic beat in this film. That is an entire comedic beat.
And it's like, I mean, he does actually say, like, I would beat that. Like, it's not just like
the exact phrasing. I would whip that.
Oh, I said. Oh, I wrote down. I'd whip my wife. But then my next note is okay. F the pilot. So
right.
Sorry.
Right.
Were they just like expecting like a whole wave of cis white men to just be like, ha, right there in the audience watching this? Who was this? Who was this line written for?
Okay. I don't think that they were thinking about, like, okay, so this is like this whole like moment in the airplane, it kind of culminates in this my wife is awful joke.
Yeah, take my wife, please.
Yeah.
1980 whatever style.
But here's the thing, the setup for the joke is that Kenji is completely done. Kenji is not interested in Jory's, you know, frustrations with his wife. Also, Kenji is not his therapist. Kenji is the service worker that he hired to go ahead and, you know, take him to his wife. That being said, like, I feel like the punchline of this whole scene should have been Kenji making something like, well, I mean, what else are you going to do? Whip her or beat her? And that, I think, would have not in not being not instead of like, well, what would you do? And maybe Kenji says something like, I think a well-written scene would have probably ended with Dory saying, well, what would you do if it was your wife? And he would have been and Kenji would have said, well, I don't know. Do you want to beat her? And then it would have turned because there's a lot of little moments in this movie where Jory's whole position on how the indigenous people in this area are acting, like the guy who he finds Kenji through, he doesn't realize that he speaks English. And it's just his own, like, he could very easily have been the punchline or like his frustration with his wife is like, you know, well, what are you gonna, what is the end goal of your relationship with your wife? To subjugate her through the harshest means?
Okay, how about this? If I were to rewrite this scene, I would, they've already brought up polyamory, which happens in lots of tribes in Africa, right?
Where did they bring up polyamory?
He says, I have 19 siblings. My dad had 4 wives.
Okay, I wouldn't necessarily call that polyamory.
It's never specified if it's one, if it's like a serial monogamy or not.
No, it sounds, he had multiple wives.
Right. But there's, I mean, like, I mean, generally when I see one man having 4 different wives, I don't think of it as polyamory. I think of it as like, I say this as like a, you know, a white person who comes from a very conservative Christian background. I would not consider it polyamory. I would consider it like sister wives.
Yeah. That's what was coming to mind for me too. Right. But like, if it's culturally acceptable, and I mean, there are people who do it right, people who do it wrong with lots of different situations. I think he brings it up casually and is like cool with it. So if I were to write this scene and he's like, well, what would you do? I'd be like, well, I'd just sleep at my other wife's house. But I'm dumb. Yeah.
Well, that would make sense because of the
setup setup with the dad and everything. Yeah. Instead, they're like, no, like abuse.
Right.
That's your go-to.
Right.
Awesome. Except opposite of awesome. Okay. Can we continue to scream?
Okay. So we go from, you know, spousal abuse made into a joke to a tribe of people dying from food poisoning.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so he walks up and like, Gory walks up and like touches a lady on the shoulder and is just like, he asks a question. I'm pretty sure it's, where's the other white person? I can't hear what he says. And he starts to walk forward, okay? But then, what's his face?
Kenji
grabs him by the shoulder a little bit and it's just like, he points around, right? He goes, go this way, like behind the lady. And that's because this bag McDog face, this Jerky McGee, this human equivalent of brushing your leg on the toilet after you get out of the shower. He was about to walk through a funeral past the people viewing and attending the funeral, in between the priests or dancers or whatever they are. Definitely a shaman is in there. In front of the 4 bodies. He was going to just beeline it all the way through because he is absolutely... He's a sociopath. This guy's a psycho, like a literal psycho. If it does not benefit him, he does not care. Gory.
I would just call him ignorant, but I mean, he
actively only does things for his benefit. Okay, my notes then are like, they've chartered a plane and a helicopter, and now they're going to charter another helicopter or a plane. No, they're going to charter another plane, right?
I thought that they just took Kenji's plane.
Yeah. But that's another leg of the trip.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another charge, I assume.
I would think so. He's a good businessman.
Because lots of sociopaths, and I know I'm using psychopath and sociopath interchangeably. I do mean psychopath. He must have a shit ton of money because they've taken like several contracted flights now. It's thousands of dollars, and he hasn't done any profitable work in a while. Where's the money coming from? Which also makes me believe that Gory, he might be a trust fund baby. Tell me he doesn't reek of it.
Oh, yeah.
He wears khakis the entire time.
Yeah. He reeks of being a trust fund baby.
She seems almost genuinely likable until you consider facts.
We haven't gotten to those facts
yet. I know.
Yet.
Sorry.
After Kenji shows Gory how to actually walk behind people instead of in front of people, which is just like common courtesy. Anyways.
Shows him how to walk.
Properly. So they get into the area where Susan is at, and she's looking over this guy who is, you know, we find out that this is the chief and he is preparing to die. And she, so, you know, there's awkward tension for a brief second between these two, husband and wife.
Yeah. He's all like, well, a note, but I got your note. I was like, F- you again.
Right.
You deserved every little pen stroke of that note. And also, who said he had to follow her? I'm not a phone slammer downer. Jen, you could probably, I don't slam down phones and I don't slam doors, but if I leave, that is not an invitation. I'm done. And so the fact that she left and he went after her, I'm like,
Well, here's my question. Why couldn't he just go back to Washington, D.C. without her and let her finish her work here?
Yeah, she could not have possibly done worse than they do in this film if he weren't there.
Right. The chief explains in his native language, and Kenji is the one who's kind of translating. But it's not like the translation scene from, what is it, 13th Warrior, where, you know, they have like the translator and they're talking back and forth and everything.
My note says that I missed the translation with subtitles that like Netflix has spoiled me with. Even if there's somebody in the room, it adds a good layer to it, actually. Like the way that people talk around each other. If there are people who don't understand, if they don't have mutual language in common, like getting to see the differences in the way they talk and like getting that in, I missed it. I was like, every time it goes native dialect, I was like, could you like just, I can't fact check that. I don't have the ability to do that. Lie to me. Tell me what they're saying.
Right. And then, you know, eventually they ask the chief what they specifically ate, and he draws a picture of
he pushes away a book where he's showing him like a hippopotamus, which is the most dangerous mammal in all of Africa, right? So like, good guess.
Yeah.
But he's like pushing away, he's like, no, stupid white guy from Red Cross, and he grabs a stick and he's like, I can do a better illustration. And he just draws in the dirt a brontosaurus.
And it is a pretty decent illustration.
Decent. Yeah. And she goes, that looks like a brontosaurus. And I'm like, no, you've only said brontosaurus 15 times in this film already.
Right.
But I will say, graces to this movie, he does not then turn over and die.
Right.
But you thought he was going to.
It's very clear that that's where the character is going, but we don't have to see it.
Yeah, he might have survived. We can just headcanon that he survived.
Okay, yeah, I agree. He survived.
And he wrote a memoir that was like, I tried to sacrifice these white people to the dinosaur, but it didn't work out. And now no one knows about it.
Flight upriver.
We totally glossed over the fact that Kenji has like bottles of fuel in his back seat.
He comes prepared for every contingency.
Yeah, but they're like glass bottles clinking with like jet fuel. Like, it's crazy. It's crazy. But I love that about him.
And then we cut after we see everybody kind of. Yeah. Okay. So all we see is the airplane going up the river. And then,
have we had the scene where the guy finds out that she's upriver from him going to a more
that's like after like I believe that after we see the brontosaurus, that's when Susan and Gory are like, yep, we're going to go ahead and do this. And then we see then it cuts to the plane going upriver. And then we cut to the dig where Nigel is, you know, coming in to Eric and being like, oh, she found out she's going upriver to blah, 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 blah. And he was like, how did you find this out? Oh, Dr. Dubois from the Red Cross.
And I'm like, how does he not know he's the bad guy? He has to know. He stabbed a guy. He's trying to thwart a woman's work in STEM. he's obviously the bad guy.
Applauders, you just need to ask yourself one question. Have you stabbed someone recently? Have you thwarted a woman?
In STEM?
In STEM?
Dr. Eric Kiviat is loosely based on Dr. Roy Mackel of the University of Chicago. Biologist, engineer, teacher, and biochemist. And his voyages to Africa in search of the legendary living dinosaurs of the Congo, Mackel's 1980 Congo trip with fellow cryptozoologist James Powell was featured in Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World, Dragons, Dinosaurs, and Giant Snakes in 1980.
So something that I kind of wanted to bring up is they were in the wrong place this entire time. They thought they were in the right place, but they were in the wrong place. And because of the information that Susan gave, because she was trying to, you know, fulfill her lifelong dream of being a doctor in archaeology or whatever the study of dinosaur bones is.
Pretty. She's looking for a dinosaur. It is archaeology.
Yeah. Okay. Then in the end, like all of this happens because a woman wants to go ahead and have a career.
How about we blame it on Dr. Dubois, who ran his mouth?
Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. White guys over the minority. That's what it is.
Okay.
Sorry.
We'll just always blame white guys.
I got a bent on this film real bad about that. Okay. Wait. So Kenji, right?
Right. So next scene, they're going ahead and you have Kenji in his plane. And then there's this other guy by the name of Charlie. And Charlie's supposed to be their guide.
Yeah, except he doesn't want to.
No, he doesn't. And Kenji and him are having a back and forth and, you know, their native language, no subtitles, but you can very easily see, and to the movie's credit, like the acting of these, well, to the actor's credit, they're making it very well known that they do not, that this guy doesn't want to do it.
Neither of them want to do it.
Yeah, and Kenji's just like, no problem. And then he flies off.
Okay, okay, so he flies away. Cut to them being like, tell him that we gotta, he needs to translate for us and the food and like the blah, blah, blah. And admittedly, like they know something about being out in the bush, right? But like, okay, but then they look up and he's like rowing away in a inflatable raft. And my notes go, I appreciate any character that ditches the entitled white people.
My note about Charlie was, Kenji offers his buddy to help and Charlie GTFOs.
Yes, he does. Yes, go Charlie. Yeah. Charlie is the most least worst person in this film, I think.
Most least worst person.
Yeah. And it's because he nopes the hell out. Good for you, Charlie. I'll remember your name. Oh, okay. So now, all of a sudden, they're surrounded by a tribe.
Well, they're walking through the wilderness, and they note in the dialogue that something big walked through here, and there's like all of these broken branches and everything, and then suddenly
they're surrounded.
Poof, they're surrounded.
Yeah.
Oh, but Polaroid saves the day.
Yeah, okay, so she's like, give them something. Now, he's just come up to chastise his wife into coming back to New York. So, like, what the f*** gifts does he have for anybody?
His watch?
Yeah. Okay, but also, they know they're going to a very sequestered tribe out in the middle of nowhere compared to where they've been. There's customs that generally lend themselves towards bringing a gift of community to people. I mean, I just watched, and I don't even watch Family Guy, but I just watched one where, like, Chris shows up and is just like, I brought your teddy bear. And Stewie goes, did you bring a gift? And he's like, no, why? And he's like, it's customary to bring a hostess gift of glass of flowers or a bottle of wine, but I guess you didn't do that. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's this movie. Like, they should have known. But so he offers the watch and she's like, let him hear it tick. And I'm like, what the f-? And then he's like, it's a digital watch. And so he makes it beep and they're like, this is stupid. And we're all like, yeah, this is stupid. I don't even need translations for this. And then she pulls out the camera. And then the thing I hate about this scene is it's scared it's going to take our soul.
That's what he says. That's what Gory says.
Yeah, because he's a racist piece of shit.
Keep a tighter lid on that racism, Gory.
Yeah. Wait, how about you air it out and just don't have it, Gory? Maybe you just like don't. Maybe he's been in Africa for like, I presume, months. And he's still just garbage. Okay, but then she wins them over with the Polaroids because they are not savages. And they do, like, pictures of themselves. And they don't think their souls are trapped in a photograph. Duh.
And then we get picture day!
Yes, it's kind of a cute montage, yeah. I would say. They all seem really excited. There's some nakedness in this scene. It's fine. It's not sexualized again. We cut to the men. Now, it is common for African tribes to separate men and women and then like have like their little conversations, like especially if they're splitting food or they're doing preparations for a meal or an event, they'll split off and they all have their own gender binary roles. And so he's off with the other men eating corn porridge or cassava porridge. I'm a bit of a foodie, sorry. The thing is, if it's accurate to a isolated tribe, it would probably be cassava. But if it, and it looks like corn porridge, that means they've had Western contact, because African tribes didn't receive corn until they had Western contact. So like, I'm like staring at it and he's just super grossed out by it. But I can't imagine going to a place and being like, oh, your food is disgusting. And I can tell you straight to your face because we don't speak the same language.
Okay, so here's my theory.
Take it.
So he uses the phrase craporama. What if that is the, and I mean, the movie has already demonstrated that, the indigenous people in this area know English. So what if this tribe knows only one word in English and it's craporama, and they know it for its full context. They know it's negative. They know it's sarcastic. And they're just like, and he just has to say that one word. And they're like, okay, we know who this guy is. So when Gory hands him the granola bar, which
the half-eaten granola bar,
the guy chews it and is just like, yeah, I don't like this either.
He spits it out hilariously. Yeah,
but he also like whispers to his friends, this is some crabby shit. But you don't actually hear that in English, but you can see it in the acting, which is, again, commendable for the actors. They do a really good job. But that's my headcanon, is that they know one English word and it's craporama.
He talks about how there are dead bugs in it. And I'm like, that's just added protein. As far as I'm concerned, that's organically grown protein. Enjoy that. But he turns around as he's hating life and verbalizing it. And he turns around, he sees her holding a baby, a cute crying naked baby. And he like tilts his head and he's just like, oh, and that's where my notes say, she looks good holding a baby. Not that the baby is or the baby has taken a shit, but it's that he looks at her and is just like, ah, oh, yes, I have affection for this woman who can carry my seed. She's like, to him, she is a sexy lamp. I think she's a more faceted character than that, but to him, nothing.
Agreed. Oh, another important moment in this scene is we learn that the leader of this tribe is named Sefu. That's his name. But then evening libations as a means to leave these white people alone in the wilderness.
Well, they don't, I think, intend to.
Right.
They first think it's beer, which is commonly made all over the world. And it can be made out of number of vegetations. He calls it near beer, which is a thing I'm not familiar with.
I think he's just describing that it's near to beer.
I've heard the term near beer, though, before, okay. So I'm not sure. It turns out that they get more woozy than just alcohol. And so I was like, ayahuasca? Maybe it's got some sort of psychedelic properties. Maybe
it's just really strong.
We don't know. But they both seem to have been familiar with alcohol. You know, they're not coming out there claiming to be like super abstinent for any reason. Like, they're not like, oh, yes, our Mormon mission trip to. No, they're like, oh, yeah, near beer. I'm familiar with alcohol. Right. And then it's something else. But she like kind of like she moves from his right side to his left side so she can sit next to, I presume, the leader. She pulls out a notebook with a cartoon sketch almost. It's just an outline of a brontosaurus. And she's like, have you seen this? And he's all like, he mumbles to himself to the side. And it cuts to them both looking really woozy. And then the drums automatically stop and they kind of look up and everyone is gone.
Yeah. So there's a definition I found on the internet for near beer. And it's a malt liquor. So we get more racist as we go on. These people think it's just like,
oh my God,
it's a malt liquor.
Oh, okay.
That does not contain enough alcohol to be considered an alcoholic beverage.
Oh, like a ginger beer, like an O'Doul's.
Yeah, something like a drink. It's a drink that resembles beer, but with less than 0.5% alcohol.
Okay. Well, near beer, malt liquor. This movie. So he's like, he throws down the cups as they look around. The fires are still going. And he's like, well, we should build a tent.
Look, sometimes you get a little drunk. Sometimes you don't realize that you've passed out. Maybe they were just, you know, maybe they were just passed out with their eyes open, standing up. We don't know. I like the idea that they were just like conked out. And
yeah, they blacked out for a second and then like the music stopped and they're like, oh, the party ended and nobody told me.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't been there. Okay.
But it wasn't a minute. It was like a solid hour.
I mean, like there were like 30 plus people there dancing and singing and dressed up and nobody was like, okay, remember to sleep on your stomach. Okay. Okay. Drink some water. Have an aspirin. Okay. Yeah. See you tomorrow. Probably. See you tomorrow. Mm. He has a big ass tent for the size of packs they were carrying. Did you notice?
Yeah.
It's like a 4-person tent and he's carrying it around.
It needs to be big for very specific reasons later on. But that's not the thing that got me.
What?
It was the moment where Susan. Okay, so Gory starts, you know, macking on her. And she's just like, I don't want to do this tonight. And my note goes, so everything around them stops, but not George.
Yeah, the crickets and everything stop. And he's just like, yeah, no, we should bang. And she's all like, I don't really think so. And then like he goes in for it and she's like, well, OK. And then like all of the sounds around them stop. And she goes, I don't think I'm in the mood anymore. Which, if you're a person who believes in informed consent, that's a hard stop. You're done now. You close up shop. If you're unzipped, zip it up. If you are too close, you uncuddle. You like give the person space and you whatever your agreement is, you can talk it out. But you don't get to try to pound it out. You know what I'm saying? So right there, Gory is just still like just skyrocketing up my bag meter. And he goes, OK, and it gets worse. He goes, aw, come on. And she's all like, OK.
But then Dinosaur, we hear like this,
yes,
this like yes, stomping, yes, in the area that they're in.
Flock and Dinosaur enter my life.
Right. This is a movie with dinosaurs in it.
Dinos have to come back to life to get him to stop. That's what it takes for him to stop. A dinosaur has to come back to life. Oh, this fucking asshole.
We don't know if this is dad or mom dinosaur, but it tears down their tent.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to think that I would do the same thing that dinosaur did.
That dinosaur speaks English too.
I would walk in front. I mean, I love the idea of like putting people in their place by like, I got into these compilations of women telling people how they would make men stupidly uncomfortable to get them to stop being douchey. And one of my favorites is act like they're a kindergartner and just say what they're doing to them. She said she didn't want any sex. Do we have sex with our friends who don't want any? She said no, but you're acting like she said yes. Is that correct?
I once saw this meme where a woman was like, this guy sent me a dick pic. So then I sent him a dick pic and he stopped sending me dick
yeah!
pics.
Yeah, send him all the dick pics.
Mm-hmm.
Serve it right back to him. Like, oh, what's your name? And they're like, I don't know, my name's Leslie. Leslie? Isn't that a girl's name? Just serve it right back to him. Gory, isn't your picture in the dictionary next to Bag McButtface? Hey, but hey, we saw the dinosaur. The tent goes down. How about we cut to the militia hired by evil scientists spraying deer on who apparently on this page I called Worth.
Spraying deer?
That's our
business.
go back. Okay, cut to the militia hired by evil scientists spraying beer on who I've apparently called Worth on this page.
Okay, that would be Nigel, yeah, in his map shirt.
Yeah.
They're on a boat and he's like, can you please turn it down? And they're like,
no,
beer. He goes to it and he turns it down saying, could you please turn it down?
Right. I have a problem. I like to think I'm accommodating, and I was I worked in an environment where I could have music playing. If someone asked, I would turn it down instantly. I would be horribly embarrassed. I would turn it right down. But the times people came over and turned it off for me was a very much like, you're not being courteous to me and I need to control my environment. And I'm like, but right now, all I think is you feel privileged to touch my things because you have an opinion.
When you actually get racist to tell you reasons why they don't like Black people, one of the first things they mention is that they're loud.
Yeah. If somebody talks about food smelling too strong, I'm like, oh, is it just because it's something you haven't been experiencing? Does your cabinet only have garlic powder and salt and pepper? Yeah, I get it. I get it. I've been there. I'm not there anymore. And just because it is not your experience doesn't mean it's not valid of a way to experience life. So he's on a whole boat. They have one little boom box right at the front of the boat. Go to the other side of the boat.
Also, when the professor is like, could your men not be so rambunctious or something? The colonel in charge of them is like, they're allowed to, you know, have fun because they are at war all the time. Or it's,
oh,
so, it's something like that.
I missed that line, but I like that.
Yeah. So it's like he's standing up for his people. Well, he knows.
He's like whiskey for my men and beer for my horses.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, which is a white guy anthem, but like, you, like everybody deserves that. Yeah, I get it. Yeah. Oh, okay. So now we cut back, right? Oh, unless this is the scene where evil scientist talks to the colonel and is just like, I see big things for you. Does he do that in this scene?
He does.
Yeah, so he was just like, yeah, you scratch my back, I'll find someone to your
essentially.
Yeah. So, okay, so evil scientist is like, he's not even like the most compelling part of this entire movie. We just have to have a bad guy. We go to a music swell. And it is not but it is this movie's version of it.
So this is the moment where Gory and Susan are walking through the wilderness and they see a dinosaur in the distance.
And they're upwind of it, so the dinosaur doesn't catch its scent, their scent, which is what apparently drew it to them earlier. And she's like, get my camera. And I was like thinking she had her Polaroid still, but apparently she didn't. And that's nice. Okay, this is where my notes go. He doesn't take any notes. He writes nothing down.
He's supposed to be a journalist, right?
Yeah. She takes copious notes. It's a turning point in the story. And he doesn't do anything.
Yeah, but, you know, he remembers things and then he just writes them down later. And he doesn't actually have to worry about, like, writing down notes. I mean, like,
writing notes is women's work. You, Gory.
Look, he got the job at the Washington Post because his dad went to the, you know, same fraternity as the editor of the Washington Post.
A member of the Skull and Bones Club.
Yeah. Look, the editor, what is it? His dad took some very salacious pictures of the editor of the Washington Post and he blackmailed to get his son into there. So he doesn't, this kid, he, Gory doesn't have to work, basically, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's obvious.
Or not work hard.
Okay, so they decide that they need to become friends with the dinosaurs. They see that there are three of them. There's a mommy and a daddy and a baby. And they are, by size, stereotypically the daddy, the mommy, and the baby. and I feel like they're almost gendered in the way that they're portrayed. Fun fact, it took brontosauruses 10 years to become fully mature. So they might be 15-year-old parents with a, like, 5-year-old son.
In human years or brontosaurus years?
I don't know what brontosaurus years are.
You're the one who brought up the fact that they were 10.
Google search said there was an interesting fact about brontosauruses and it was 10 years until they were mature.
Okay, so then when you say that they're 15-year-olds with a baby, are you thinking that they're teenage brontosauruses with a baby?
Yes, because I only talk in Earth years.
But they're mature at 10 years old.
Yeah, they're adults.
So they're adults in brontosaurus years.
I wouldn't be mad at a 3-year-old dog
they're
having
middle
puppies.
Age, they are middle-aged. They are middle-aged brontosauruses.
I don't know. Unfortunately, that same blurb I read on the internet doesn't tell me how long brontosaurus live.
Well, not
very long. Hour 33 of the podcast, and we continued. Okay, so they decide they're going to become friends by...
I did want to reiterate that the sizes of the models, because you mentioned, well, we just know that it's like the daddy is probably the bigger one.
Yeah.
But it's 75 feet, 60 feet, and 10 feet for the models.
That sounds right. I didn't actually look at that part of the blurbs I was looking at. Because I didn't want this to be a book report about Brontosaurus. Because that's not the point of this podcast. Accuracy is not a part of this podcast. Except for Sean Facts, which we lean heavily on.
This isn't even our first dinosaur movie this year, though. Super Mario Brothers.
Yo, I'm a dinosaur from New York.
Hey, this is my dinosaur, Yoshi. Gory decides that he needs to friend the dinosaurs by climbing a tree and getting mumbo fruit.
I think it's also Susan's idea. He's just helping her because he's like, oh, this is the discovery of the century.
Every second he can in this film climb a tree. He, in fact, does.
He also gets off. Do you know how he gets off that tree?
Probably by, like, being, come on, let me off this tree. That's how he gets off.
I mean, it wasn't that dirty. He swings on a vine. He's like, see, I'm George of the Jungle. And I was like, don't compare yourself to Brendan Fraser.
Accurate. And if you'd like to hear us sing Brendan Fraser's praises, well, please go back an episode or three. Two. One episode behind this one, but like we're on part like four.
Part four?
Part five? How many parts are there?
Part 200 million years ago.
Every time I go on a rant against white people being racist pieces of shit, it adds 20 more minutes. Okay. Okay, yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's the whole scene where they have the bat, where they, you know, where George is in the water and then the baby dinosaur shows up.
Before that happens, the baby comes out to eat the fruit and my notes go, do one thing. And then she says, they're getting used to us. You made one pile of fruit and you tricked an infant.
Oh, right. But the mom also comes out, too.
I don't think that means they're used to you. I just think it means they're hungry.
Yeah. I mean, like, I walked on a trail this morning and there were rabbits and, you know, one of them ran away from me and the other just hopped slightly and then started eating clover. And I mean, that was a wonderful interaction. I don't think they're getting used to me.
I was sitting in the backyard on the deck enjoying some sunshine and a little tiny bird flew down by my foot like a step away and I was like, am I a Disney princess now? And then I made eye contact with the bird said oh shit in bird and then flew away and I was like, yeah, no, that's probably true. I'm not a princess.
I once had a squirrel hop on my leg. I was wearing like jeans and everything.
What?
But like I used
what?
To feed.
You are a princess then.
I used to feed the squirrels in my backyard with like unsalted peanuts. And I had one in my hand about to give it to him, but that squirrel was like, I want it now. And so it came up, it jumped on my leg as I'm holding the peanut, and then I put it down on the ground, and then it jumped off. It was the greatest experience.
I have a core memory of being out at a national park, and we were unsupervised. This is the same park where like a moose just walked through.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the kids, because you make camping friends over the weekend or whatever, were like, there's a raccoon, right? And I was like, oh, really? And I ran back and I grabbed a cracker. I remember it was a Ritz cracker. And I ran to where the raccoon was. And everybody's scared of rabies. And I held out the raccoon to this cracker to this raccoon. And he took it like this. You can't tell, but I'm extending my arms and then clasping it like I was smashing cymbals together. And he goes and he eats it. And I'm like, I am the queen of the woods. I wasn't really. This was like a very tended campground, but it was awesome.
Okay, one last thing and then we'll move on from these adorable animals. There is a video of a raccoon stuck in what I think is a mailbox and someone puts a popsicle in that mailbox and the raccoon is just like tearing into it and then it calms down as soon as it realizes that the popsicle is delicious.
He's in a cat carrier. I've seen that exact video. No, you're right.
That is literally the reaction that anything should give if it's first given a popsicle.
Mm-hmm. I'm like that.
George of the Jungle. No, you are not Brendan Fraser.
Yeah, now we're going back to swim. I call this scene swimming bag.
So like,
oh no, I call it the swimming debacle. I can't read my own handwriting.
But well, George is swimming and the little dino shows up and they have this. One of the things that Kenji gave them was this tracker that they'd be able to find him. And so they Susan like throws the tracker, the bit that they put onto the animal, and he grabs it, and then the dinosaur gets his clothes and then dips down in the water.
Yeah, they're both in the water. Yeah. Begging baby, as they call him.
And so there's like, you know, this like, it's this wacky little moment where the baby's above the water, but George is underneath it.
And then they switch places.
And then they get down both underneath the water. And then when they see each other in the water, they go like, ah!
The baby runs out of the water. And she's like, oh, you scared it. And this is the part where I wanted him to be like, well, he scared the shit out of me first, which would have been funny. But instead, he just walks around in his underwear because he needs to be shirtless as often as possible. Have you noticed that?
Mm-hmm.
Sick of this guy being shirtless. He's not bad to look at, but he's not good to look at either.
I would not want to look at him naked, partly because of his personality.
This is the thing. The second your mouth f***ed up for me, I don't care how pretty you are.
Agreed. Baddies show up to take the dinos.
Yeah, evil scientist and the mom gets tranked.
Yeah, I said trank mom, kill dad.
I dubbed him Datasaur.
Thank you for continuing deep into the woods with us, a plotter. We're now two-thirds of the way into our full walkthrough of 1985's Baby, Secret of the Lost Legend. Are you looking for a bit more nostalgia in your week? Invasion of the Remake has had a ton of fun remaking 1986's Critters. And Blockbuster Mentality has a discussion on a film we've done as well, Harold and Maude. Check out links to these episodes in this release's description. Hey, this is your audio engineer and Jen of the jungle. Jen, did you know that there's a way to make our long-lost show stand out from the rest and bring us into the light for others to see? By writing a review. Letting us know how we're doing by leaving a rating or review on Podchaser.com or Apple Podcasts helps boost us in search results, bringing us that much closer to finding new applauders. We'll be back next week with our Shocked and Applaudable Moments with Part 3. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.